Parks makes a gesture. In the near dark, Justin, who can't see what gesture it is. Keep a lid on the madhouse. Keep the whole place ticking over, month after month, on string and good intentions. Christ, it's amazing we lasted as long as we did. Not enough men, not enough supplies, no fucking communications, no proper chain of command. He seems to stop very suddenly, which makes Justinu go back over his words to figure out which ones he wishes he hadn't said. When did communications stop? She asks him. He doesn't answer, so she asks again. Last message from Beacon was about 5 months back, Parks admits. Normal signalling wavelengths have been empty ever since. Shit! Justinu is deeply shaken. So we don't even know if... Shit! Most likely it just means they relocated the tower, Parks says. Wouldn't even have to be far. The goose-together crap we're using for radios. They don't work unless they're pointed right at the signal source. It's like trying to shoot a basketball into a hoop across 60 bloody miles. They fall silent, contemplating this. The night seems wider now. And colder. My God, Justinu says at last. We might be the last. The four of us. We're not the last. You don't know that?
Yeah, I do. The Junkers are doing fine.
The Junkers? Justinu's tone is sour. She's heard stories, and now she's seen them for herself. Survivalists who've forgotten how to do anything else besides survive. Parasites and scavengers almost as inhuman in their own way as Ophiocordyceps. They don't build or preserve, they just stay alive. And their ruthlessly patriarchal structures reduce women to pack animals or breeding stock. If that's humanity's last, best hope, then despair might actually be preferable. There have been dark ages before, Park says, reading her a lot better than she likes. Things fall down and people build them up again. There's probably never been a time when life was just steady state. There's always some crisis. And then there's the rest of the world, you know? Beacon was in touch with survivor communities in France, Spain, America, all kinds of places. The cities were hit worst. Any place where there was a whole bunch of people crammed in together, and a lot of infrastructure fell with the cities. In less developed areas, the contagion didn't spread so fast. There could be some places it never even reached at all. Parks fills her glass. I wanted to ask you something, he says. Go on. Yesterday, you said you were ready to take the kid and split up from the rest of us. So? Did you mean it, by the way? That's not the question, but would you really have cut loose and tried to make it back to Beacon on your own? I meant it when I said it. Yeah. He takes a sip of his brandy. Thought so. Anyway, you called me something just before you shoved your gun in Gallagher's face. It didn't make any sense to me at the time. You said we were hardwired soldier boys. What does hardwired mean? Justinu is embarrassed. It's a sort of insult, she says.
Yeah. Well, I'd have been surprised if it was a kiss on the cheek.
I was just curious. Does it mean like we're really ruthless or something? No. It's a term from psychology. It describes a behaviour that you were born with and can't change, or that's programmed into you so you don't even think about it. It's just automatic. Parks laughs.
Like the Hungries, he suggests.
Justinu is a little abashed, but she takes it on the chin. Yes, she admits, like the Hungries.
You give good trash talk, Parks compliments her. Seriously. That's outstanding.
He tops up her glass again. And he puts his arm around her shoulder.
Justin, who pulls away quickly.
What the hell is this?
She demands.
I thought you were cold,
Park says, sounding surprised.
You were shivering, sorry. I didn't mean anything by it.
For a long time, she just stands there staring at him, in dead silence. Then she speaks, and there's only one thing she can think of to say. She spits it out at him, like she wants to spit out, retrospectively, the booze, the memory, the last 3 years of her life. You ever kill a kid? Chapter 40. The question hits Park squarely between the eyes. He was feeling pretty mellow up to this point. The brandy has soaked into him, dulling the pain from the many tiny shrapnel wounds he took in his legs and lower back when the stairs went to pieces. And here he thought the two of them were getting along. But no. The teacher's got him clearly defined in her personal encyclopedia. For Parks, Sergeant, see bastard, bloodthirsty. He's got a range of answers for this one, most of which would involve reminding her how she's been able to stay off the Hungry's lunch menu for the last 3 years, where her computer came from, and most of the other handy little gadgets that let her do her job. Why Beacon is still standing, if it is, for them to come home to. But skip it. This isn't going where he was hoping it would. And there's nothing to be gained by telling this very attractive woman that she's both a hypocrite and a whole lot stupider than he thought. It will only make the journey that bit harder. So he writes it off and heads for the fire door. I'll leave you to enjoy the view, he says over his shoulder.
I mean, before the breakdown,
Justinu says to his back.
It's a straight question, Parks.
Which makes him stop and turn around again.
What the hell do you think I am?
He asks her.
I don't know what you are. Answer the question. Did you?
He doesn't need to think about the answer. He knows where his lines are. They're not built to move the way some people's are. No. I've shot Hungries as young as 5 or 6. You don't have much choice when they're trying to eat you alive. But I never killed a kid who you could really say was still alive.
Well, I did. Now it's her turn to turn away. She tells him the story without ever making eye contact with him, even though the rampart of a nearby chimney stack throws their faces into shadow and makes eye contact conditional in any case. In the confessional, you never see the priest's face. But Parks is willing to bet that no priest ever had a face like his.
I was driving home, after a party. I'd been drinking, but not that much. And I was tired. I was working on a paper and I'd had a couple of weeks of early mornings and late nights, trying to bring it in. None of this matters. It's just, you know, you try to make sense of it afterwards. You look for reasons why it happened.
The words come out of Helen Justinu in a flat monotone. Parks thinks of Gallagher's written report with its preceding twos and its thereupons. But Justinu's bowed head and the tightness of her grip on the parapet wall add their own commentary. I was driving along this road, in Hertfordshire, between South Mimms and Potter's Bar. A few houses every now and then, but mostly miles of hedges, then a pub, and some more hedges. I wasn't expecting, I mean it was late, way after midnight. I didn't think anyone at all would be out, still less. Someone ran into the road in front of me. He came through a gap in one of the hedges, I think. There wasn't anywhere else he could have come from. He was just there. Suddenly, and I hit the brakes, but I was already right on top of him. It didn't make a bit of difference. I must have been going over 50 when I hit him, and he bounced off the car like a ball. I stopped a long way up the road, 100 yards or so. I got out and came running back. I was hoping, obviously,
But he was dead. No question. A boy. About 8 or 9 years old, maybe. I'd killed a child. Broken him in pieces. Inside his skin, so his arms and legs didn't even bend the right way. I think I stayed there a long time. I was shaking and crying, and I couldn't get up. It felt like a long time. I wanted to run away, and I couldn't even move. She looks at the sergeant now, but the darkness hides her expression almost completely. Only the twisted line of her mouth shows. It reminds him, right then, of the line of his scar. "But then I did," she says. "I did move. I got up and I drove away. Locked my car in the garage and went to bed. I even slept, Parks. Can you believe that? I never did make up my mind what to do about it. If I confessed, I'd most likely go to jail, and my career would be over, and it wouldn't bring him back, so what would be the point? Of course, I knew damn well what the point was. And I picked up that phone about 6 or 7 times in the next couple of days, but I never dialed. And then the world ended, so I didn't have to. I got away with it. Got away clean. Parks waits a long time, until he's absolutely certain that Justinu's monologue is finished. The truth is, for most of the time he's been trying to figure out what it is exactly that she's trying to tell him. Maybe he was right the first time about where they were heading, and Justinu airing her ancient laundry is just a sort of palate cleanser before they have sex. Probably not, but you never know. In any case, the countermove to a confession is an absolution, unless you think the sin is unforgivable. Parks doesn't. "It was an accident," he tells her, pointing out the obvious. "And probably you would have ended up doing the right thing. You don't strike me as the sort of person who just lets shit slide." He means that, as far as it goes. One of the things he likes about Justinu is her seriousness. He frigging flat out hates frivolous, thoughtless people who dance across the surface of the world without looking down. "Yeah, but you don't get it," Justinu says. "Why do you think I'm telling you all this?"
"I don't know," Parks admits. "Why are you telling me?"
Justinu steps away from the parapet wall and squares off against him. Range, 0 meters. It could be erotic, but somehow it's not. "I killed that boy, Parks. If you turn my life into an equation, the number that comes out is -1. That's my lifetime score, do you understand me? And you. You and Caldwell and Private Ginger fucking Rogers. My God, whether it means anything or not, I will die my own self before I let you take me down to -2. She says the last words right into his face, sprays him with little flecks of spit. This close up, dark as it is, he can see her eyes. There's something mad in them, something deeply afraid, but it's damn well not afraid of him. She leaves him with the bottle. It's not what he was hoping for, but it's a pretty good consolation prize. Chapter 41. Caroline Caldwell waits until the sergeant and Justinu leave the room. Then she gets up quickly and goes through into the kitchen. She saw the Tupperware boxes earlier, stacked in the furthest cupboard along, ranged in order of size so they formed a steep-sided pyramid. Nobody else spared them a second glance because the boxes were empty. But Caldwell noted them with a small surge of pleasure. Every so often, even now, the universe gives you exactly what you need. She takes 6 boxes of the smallest size and 6 teaspoons, dropping them one by one into the pockets of her lab coat. She brings a torch, too, but doesn't turn it on until she reaches her destination and closes the door. She breathes in shallow sips. The smell of the human remains and of years of enclosed decay freights the air so heavily it's almost a physical presence. With the spoons, Caldwell takes a range of samples from the hungry that was killed by Sergeant Parks. She's only interested in brain tissue, but multiple samples mean more chance of getting at least one that's not too badly contaminated by flora and fauna from skin, clothes, or ambient air. After sealing each container carefully, she puts them back into her pockets. She discards the soiled spoons, for which she has no further use. She thinks as she works, "I should have done this years ago. Men like the sergeant have their uses, and she knows she could never have collected the test subjects by herself. But if she'd been there with the trappers as part of the team, she wouldn't have to rely on their inadequate observations and unreliable memories. So she wouldn't have wasted so much time exploring blind alleys. So she would have known, for example, that although most hungries have only the two states, the rest state and the hunting state, some have a third state that corresponds to a degraded version of normal consciousness. They can interact with the world around them, fitfully and partially, in ways that echo their behaviour before they were infected. The woman with the baby carriage. The singing man with his wallet full of photos. These are trivial examples, but they represent something momentous. Caldwell is very close, she knows, to an unprecedented breakthrough. She can't do anything with these samples until she gets back to Beacon and has access to a microscope. But an idea is forming in her mind as to what it is she should be looking for, what shape her research will take once she's back in a lab and has everything she needs, including, of course, test subject number one, Melanie. Chapter 42. Justinu is roused from sleep by a hand shaking her shoulder. She panics momentarily, thinking that she's being attacked, but it's Parks she's struggling against, Parks's grip that she's trying to slap away. And it's not just her. He's waking everyone, telling them to get their asses over to the window. The sun has come up on a pretty ugly and depressing state of affairs, and they need to see it. The hungries who chased them the day before have not dispersed. They stand two or three deep along the length of the fence around Wainwright House, most of them having stopped dead when they hit that barrier. The downstairs hall is full of those who didn't stop, who chased their human quarry all the way inside. From the stump of the top stair, you can stand and look down on a crowd of gaunt, gaping monsters standing shoulder to shoulder like the audience for some sellout event. Which would be breakfast. Tense and scared, the four of them canvass possibilities. They can't shoot their way out, obviously. They could waste all their ammunition and not even make a dent in those numbers. Besides, loud noise was the trigger that got them into this mess in the first place. Producing more of it runs the risk of attracting more monsters from even further afield. Justinu wonders if maybe they could use that. If you were to throw some hand grenades, she suggests to Parks, say, from the top of the roof, the hungries will target on the sound, right? We could draw them off, and then when the fence is clear, we just run in the opposite direction. Parks spreads his empty hands. No grenades, he says. I just had the ones on my belt, and I used them all when I pulled up the drawbridge last night. Gallagher opens his mouth. Shuts it. Tries again. Could make some Molotovs, he suggests. He nods towards the kitchen. There's bottles of cooking oil in there. I don't believe breaking bottles would make a particularly loud noise, Dr. Caldwell says acerbically. It might be loud enough, Parks muses, but he doesn't sound convinced. Even if it wasn't, we could set fire to the fuckers and clear a bit of space for ourselves that way. Not the ones downstairs in the hallway, Caldwell counters. I don't relish the prospect of being trapped in a burning building. And there'd be smoke, Justinu says. Probably a lot of it. If the junkers are still looking for us, we'd be putting up a big sign telling them where we are. Just
empty bottles then, Gallagher says. No oil. We try to draw them away with the sound. Parks looks out of the window. He doesn't even need to say it. The distance from the roof and windows of the house to the pavement outside the fence is about 30 yards. You could throw a bottle that far, but you'd need to put your shoulder into it, and you'd want luck and the wind to both be with you. If the thrown bottles fall short, they'll just entice the hungries who stopped at the gates to come on inside. Same thing would have gone for grenades, too, of course. They probably would have done more harm than good. They go back and forth, but nobody can suggest an easy or obvious way out. They've let themselves get cornered by predators who won't lose interest or wander away. Waiting this out isn't an option, and all the other options look bad. Justin, who goes to check on Melanie. The girl is already on her feet, looking out of the window, but she turns at the sound of footsteps. Probably she heard their conversation in the next room. Justin, who tries to reassure her, "We'll think of something," she says. "There's a way out of this." Melanie nods calmly. "I know," she says. Parks doesn't like the idea, which doesn't surprise Justinu at all, and Caldwell likes it even less. Only Gallagher seems to approve, and he doesn't do more than nod, seeming reluctant to say anything that directly contradicts his sergeant. They're sitting in the day room, on 4 chairs that they've pulled up into a small circle. It provides the illusion that they're talking to each other, although Caldwell is off in her own world, Gallagher won't speak until he's spoken to, and Parks listens to nobody but himself. "I don't like the idea of letting her off the leash," he says, for about the 3rd time. "Why the hell not?" Justinu demands. "You were happy enough to cut her loose 2 days ago. The leash and the handcuffs were so she could stay with us. Your idea of a compromise. So, from your point of view, there's nothing to lose here. Nothing at all. If she does what she says she'll do, we're out of this mess. If she runs away, we're no worse off than we are now." Caldwell ignores this speech and makes her appeal directly to the sergeant. "Melanie belongs to me," she reminds him, "to my program. If we lose her, it will be your responsibility." It's the wrong thing to say. Parks doesn't seem to like being threatened. "I spent 4 years servicing your program, Doc," he reminds her. "Today is my day off." Caldwell starts to say something else, but Parks talks over her, to Justinu. "If we let her go, why would she come back?" "I wish I could answer that," Justinu says. "Frankly, it's a complete mystery to me. But she says she will, and I believe her. Maybe because we're all she knows. Maybe because she's got a crush on me, and all love is as blind as it needs to be." "I want to talk to her," Parks says. "Bring her in." On the leash still, with her hands behind her back and the muzzle over her mouth, she faces Parks like the chieftain of a savage tribe, on her dignity, and Justinu is suddenly aware of the changes in her. She's out in the world now, her education accelerating from a standing start to some dangerous, unguessable velocity. She thinks of an old painting. "And when did you last see your father?" Because Melanie's stance is exactly the same as the way the kid stands in that picture. For Melanie, though, that would be a completely meaningless question. "You think you can do this?" Parks asks her instead. "What you said to Miss Justinu. You think you're up to it?" "Yes," Melanie says. "It means I'd have to trust you. Set you free. Right here in this room with us." He's been holding something in his right hand, shaking it as though it's a dice he was going to throw. He shows it to her now. The key to her handcuffs. "I don't think it means that, Sergeant Parks," Melanie says.
"No."
"No. You have to set me free, but you don't have to trust me. You should put the chemical stuff all over your skin first to make really sure I don't smell you.
And you should make Kieran unlock the handcuffs while you aim your gun at me. And you don't have to take the cage thing off my mouth. I just need to be able to use my hands. Park stares at her for a moment, like she's something written in a language he doesn't speak.
Got it all figured out, he acknowledges.
Yes.
He leans forward to look her in the eye. And you're not scared.
Melanie hesitates. Of what? She asks him.
Justin, who is amazed at that momentary pause. Yes or no would be equally easy to say, whether they were true or not. The pause means that Melanie is scrupulous, is weighing her words. It means she's trying to be honest with them. As if they've done a single thing ever to deserve that. Of the Hungries, Park says like it's obvious.
Melanie shakes her head.
How come?
They won't hurt me.
No. Why not?
Enough, Justinu snaps. But Melanie answers anyway, slowly, ponderously, as though the words are stones she's using to build a wall. They don't bite each other.
And?
I'm the same as them.
Almost.
Close enough so they don't get hungry when they smell me.
Parks nods slowly. This is where the catechism has been leading all this time. He wants to know how much Melanie has already guessed, where her head is. He's working his way through the logistics.
The same as them?
Or almost the same? Which is it?
Melanie's face is unreadable, but some powerful emotion flits across it, doesn't settle. I'm different. Because I don't want to eat anyone.
No. Then what was that red stuff all over you when you jumped on board the Humvee day before yesterday? Looked like blood to me.
Sometimes I need to eat people. I never want to.
That's all you've got, kid. Shit happens.
Another pause. Longer this time. It hasn't happened to you.
Very true, Parks admits. Still feels like we're splitting hairs, though. You're offering to help us against those things down there, when it seems to me that you'd want to be down there with them, looking up at us, waiting for the dinner bell to ring. So I guess that's what I'm asking you. Why would you come back? And why would I believe you'd come back?
For the first time, Melanie lets her impatience show.
I'd come back because I want to. Because I'm with you, not with them. And there isn't any way to be with them, even if I wanted to. They're...
Whatever concept she's reaching for, it eludes her for a moment.
They're not with each other. Not ever.
Nobody answers her, but Parks looks happy with this. Like she got the secret password. She's in the club. The hopelessly outnumbered and surrounded by monsters club.
I'm with you,
Melanie says again. And then, as if it needed saying,
not you really.
I'm with Miss Justineau. Surprisingly, Park seems satisfied with this, too. He stands with a decisive air.
I get that, he says. Okay, kid. We're going to trust you to get this job done. Let's go.
Melanie stays where she is.
What? Parks demands. Something else you need?
Yes, Melanie tells him. I want to wear my new clothes, please.
Chapter 43. They take her to the top of the stairs. To where the top of the stairs was before Sergeant Parks exploded them. Melanie peers over the edge. There are lots and lots of Hungries down there. Maybe 100 or more, all standing together in the hallway. They look up as the two men and two women come into view, their heads all moving together like flowers following the sun.
Sergeant Parks doesn't get his gun out, but he makes Melanie turn away as he unlocks the cuffs, and he tells her not to move. She feels them fall away, and she wants to wiggle her fingers to make sure they still work okay. But she doesn't. Sergeant Parks unties the leash from around her neck, too, and she turns to Miss J, who's ready with the little bundle of clothes. It's unpleasant to have the sweater, Miss Justineau's sweater, which she's worn all this time, lifted off over her head, to be momentarily naked again. It's not the scrutiny of the adults she dislikes. It's the feel of air directly on her body, the sensation of being so exposed. But as Miss J dresses her in her new finery, that feeling goes away. She likes the jeans and the T-shirt very much, and the jacket, which is a little like Sergeant Parks's jacket. It's only the trainers that feel strange. She's never worn shoes before, and the loss of the stream of information her feet receive from the ground is disturbing. It's possible that she and the trainers might not be a long-term thing. But they're so beautiful.
"Done," Parks says.
"You look great, Melanie," Miss Justineau tells her. She nods thanks and agreement. She knows she does.
But they're not done. Not yet.
Miss Justineau takes something out of her pocket and holds it out for Melanie to take. It's a tiny thing, made of grey plastic. Rectangular with a single round button on it. Around the edge of the button, in red letters, are the words SAFE and GUARD. And then underneath, DANGER, 150 decibels.
"When you get to the part where you have to make a big noise," Miss Justineau tells her, "this might help."
"What is it?" Melanie asks. She's trying to look casual and calm, like getting a present from Miss Justineau is no big deal.
"It's a personal alarm, from a long time ago. People used to carry them in case they got attacked."
"By Hungries?"
"No, by other people.
It makes a noise like the end-of-the-day klaxon back at the base, but much, much louder. Loud enough to make people panic so they want to run away. But Hungries wouldn't run away. They'd run towards the sound. It might not work at all, after all this time. But you never know."
Melanie hesitates.
"You should keep it," she says, "in case you get attacked." Miss Justineau closes Melanie's fingers over the object, which is still warm from being in her pocket. It's like a little piece of Miss Justineau that she can take out into the world with her. The weight of her new knowledge is still pressing her down, but her heart swells with joy as she puts the alarm into the pocket of her brand new unicorn jeans.
"Done," she confirms to Sergeant Parks. Sergeant's face says, "About time."
He ties the leash up again around Melanie's waist with a different knot.
"Once you're down on the ground," he tells her, "you pull on this end here and the rope will come away."
"Okay," she says.
"I'm not taking your muzzle off," Sergeant says, "but with your hands free you can easily release the strap yourself and get it off. You're a smart kid, and I bet you thought of that already."
Melanie shrugs. Of course she has. And there doesn't seem to be any point in trying to explain to him all over again why she wouldn't do that.
"Just so you know," Sergeant Park says, "if you want to stay with us, you're going to need to keep the muzzle on. Or put it back on when you're done. I don't have any more of them, and as far as I'm concerned, your teeth are a loaded gun. So keep that thing safe, because that's what gets you back in the door. Okay?"
"Okay."
"Okay, then. Gallagher, give me a hand here."
The two men move into position at the top of the stairs and get ready to pay out the rope. But at the last moment, Miss Justineau kneels beside Melanie again and holds out her arms. Melanie steps into the embrace, shivers deliciously as Miss Justineau's arms close around her. But she pulls away after no more than a moment. There's just a tiny trace of the human smell, the Miss Justineau smell, underneath the bitterness of the chemicals. enough to turn the pure pleasure of their proximity into something else entirely, something that threatens to escalate out of her control.
Not safe, she mutters urgently. Not safe.
Your e-blockers, Sergeant Parks translates unnecessarily. You need another layer.
I'm sorry, Miss Justineau murmurs, not to Sergeant Parks, but to Melanie.
Melanie nods. She was scared for a moment there, but it's okay. It was a very faint scent, and now it's gone. The hungry feeling is back under her control.
Sergeant Parks tells her to sit down on the top step, and then to push herself away. He and Kieran lower her down into the waiting crowd of hungries,
who don't react at all. Some of them follow the movement as she comes down, but Sergeant Parks makes sure that her descent is really slow and gradual so that it doesn't get the hungries too excited. Their gaze sweeps over her without lingering, or else they stare right through her, not registering her presence at all. As soon as her feet are on the ground, she loosens the rope with a tug. Sergeant Parks draws it up again, just as slowly and gradually as he let it down.
Melanie glances up. She sees Sergeant Parks and Miss Justineau peering down at her. Miss Justineau waves, a slow opening and closing of her hand. Melanie waves back. She threads her way carefully through the hungries, unnoticed, unmolested. But she was lying when she said she wasn't afraid. To be right here, in the middle of them, to look up at their bowed heads and half-open mouths, their off-white eyes, is very frightening indeed. Yesterday she thought that the hungries were like houses that people used to live in. Now she thinks that every one of those houses is haunted. She's not just surrounded by the hungries, she's surrounded by the ghosts of the men and women they used to be. She has to fight a sudden urge to break into a run, to get out of here into the open air as quickly as she can. She makes it to the door, pushing between the packed together bodies. But the doorway itself is completely impassable. Too many hungries have squeezed themselves into the narrow space between the doorposts, and she's not strong enough to break up that logjam. But the floor-to-ceiling windows to either side of the door have been shattered, every last sliver of glass forced out of their frames by the hungries charging through. Some of those closest to Melanie bear the slash marks from that difficult passage on their arms and bodies. From the new wounds, a sluggish, brown liquid has oozed. It doesn't look much like blood. Melanie pushes her way out through the left-hand window. More hungries are standing out on the driveway, but they're not so tightly clustered, and it's easier for her to make her way through. To the gates, and then out onto the street. She walks past more hungries. They don't turn as she goes by, or seem to notice her at all. She crosses to the overgrown green and walks in among the trees and tall grass. Melanie likes it here. If she were free, if she had lots of time and nothing that she needed to do, she'd like to stay here for a long time and pretend that she's in the Amazon rainforest, which she knows about from a lesson with Miss Mailer a long time ago, and from the picture on the wall of her cell. But she's not free, and time is pressing. If she takes too long, Miss Justineau might think she's run away and left her. And she'd rather die than let Miss Justineau think that, even for a second. She's hoping for a rat like the one that scared Dr. Caldwell. But there are no rats. No birds, even. But in any case, a bird probably wouldn't do for what she needs. So she looks further afield, walking up and down the streets, through the open doors of houses, through the jumbled, desecrated remains of vanished lives, trying not to be distracted by the ornaments, the photos, the hundreds and thousands of inscrutable objects. In a room silted up a foot deep with old brown leaves, she startles a fox. It leaps for a broken window, but Melanie is on it so quickly that she catches it in mid-air. She's thrilled at her own speed. And at her strength. Though the fox is as big as she is, when it squirms and thrashes in her arms, she just tightens her grip, closing down its range of movement until it stills, quivering, whining, and lets her take it where she wants. Back up the street to the green, across the green to the fence where the hungries are clustered, every face turned away from her, every body still. Melanie screams. It's the loudest sound she can make. Not as loud as Miss Justineau's personal alarm would be, but both her hands are full of fox, and she doesn't want to let it go until all the hungries are looking at her. When the heads turn, she opens her arms. The fox is away like an arrow flying out of Ulysses' bow. Primed by the sound, awake and alert for prey, the hungries obey their programming. They start into violent motion, run after the fox as though they're joined to it by taut strings. Melanie backs out of the way quickly, into a doorway, as the first wave goes by her. There are so many of them, crowded in so tightly together, that some of them get knocked down and trampled on. Melanie sees them trying again and again to get up, only to be trodden underfoot each time. It's almost funny. But the grey-brown froth that's forced out of their mouths, like wine from grapes, makes it sort of sad and horrible too. When the rest of the horde have run on down the road, almost out of sight, some of these fallen struggle to their feet and limp and crawl after them. Others stay where they fell, twitching and scrabbling but too badly broken to get up off the ground. Melanie skirts around them carefully. She feels bad for them. She wishes that there was something she could do to help them, but there isn't anything. She goes back in through the gates and walks up to the house. She enters the hall, which is completely deserted now, and calls up to Sergeant Parks, who is exactly where he was when she left. It worked. They've gone now.
Stay there, Sergeant Parks calls down. We'll join you.
And then, after looking at her hard for a few moments longer,
good job, kid.
Chapter 44. Getting everyone down to street level is easy enough with the ropes. Sergeant Parks decides the order, Gallagher first, so that there's someone on the ground who knows how to use a gun, then Helen Justineau, then Dr. Caldwell, with himself bringing up the rear. Dr. Caldwell is the only one who presents any kind of problem, since her bandaged hands won't allow her to grip the rope. Parks makes a running knot, which he ties around her waist and lowers her down. They could retrace their steps, but it's easier to keep going through the town. There are any number of places where they can pick up the A1 again, and they'll actually get out from among the buildings more quickly if they steer east of south, past a region of desolate industrial estates. Not many people ever lived out here. And after the breakdown, the pickings were thin for uninfected survivors, whose needs ran more to food than to heavy plant. So they don't see many hungries at all. Of course, they're also following roughly the same line that the fox took, at least to start with. That irresistible moving target cleared the way for them very effectively. So that's twice now that the hungry kid has saved their bacon. If she makes the hat trick, maybe Parks will even start to relax a little around her. Hasn't happened yet, though. They discuss logistics as they walk, in low, measured voices that won't carry too far. Parks feels they should stick to Plan A, despite the clusterfuck they just experienced. His reasons are the same as they were. The direct route through London will save them at least 2 days' travel, and they still need shelter when they stop and sleep. Even given that the shelter can turn into a trap? Dr. Caldwell asks tartly.
Well, that's an issue, Parks allows. But on the other hand, if we'd been out in the open when those hungries came for us last night, we wouldn't have lasted 10 fucking heartbeats. Just a thought.
Caldwell doesn't attempt a comeback, so he doesn't have to remind her that it was her striking up an acquaintance with a female hungry out on the street that got them into trouble in the first place. And nobody else seems inclined to argue. They continue on their way, the conversation dying out into wary silence. Over the course of the morning, their line stretches out unacceptably. Gallagher takes point, as Parks ordered him to do. Helen Justinu sticks with the kid, who manages a reasonable pace despite her shorter legs, but keeps being distracted and slowed by the things they pass. Dr. Caldwell is slowest of all, the gap between her and the others gradually but steadily increasing. She quickens her stride whenever Parks asks her to, but always slows again after a minute or two. That desperate fatigue, so early in the day, worries him. They're moving now through a burn shadow, another artifact of the breakdown. Before the government fell apart entirely, it passed a whole series of badly thought-out emergency orders, one of which involved chemical incendiaries sprayed from helicopter gunships to create cauterized zones that were guaranteed free from hungries. Uninfected civilians were warned in advance by sirens and looped messages, but a lot of them died anyway, because they weren't free to move when the choppers flew in. The hungries, though, they ran ahead of the flamethrowers like roaches when the light goes on. All the incendiaries could do was to move them on a few miles in one direction or another, and in some cases to destroy infrastructure that might have saved a lot of lives. Luton Airport, for instance. That got torched with about 40 planes still on the ground. So when the next memo came round about evacuating the uninfected to the Channel Islands using commercial carrier fleets, all the army could do was shrug its collective shoulders and say, "Yeah, we wish." The buildings on this part of their route are foreshortened stumps, not so much burned down as rendered into tallow. The monstrous heat of the incendiaries melted not just metal but brick and stone. The ground they're walking on carries a thin black crust of grease and charcoal, the residue of organic materials that burned and sublimed, took to the air, and settled again wherever the hot winds of combustion took them. The air has a sour, acid tang to it. After 10 minutes or so, your breath is rasping in your throat, and there's an itchy feeling in your chest that you can't scratch because it's inside you. It's more than 20 years on, and still nothing grows here. Not even the hardiest and most badass of weeds. Nature's way of saying she's not stupid enough to be caught like that twice over. Parks hears the kid asking Justinu what happened here. Justinu makes heavy weather of the question, even though it's an easy one. "We couldn't kill the hungries, so we killed ourselves. That was always our favourite party trick." The burn shadow goes on for mile after mile, oppressing their spirits and draining their stamina. It's past time they stopped, grab some rest and rations, but nobody's keen to sit down on this tainted ground. By unspoken consensus, they press on. It's really sudden when they reach the edge of it, but the shadows got one more miracle to show them. Over the space of 100 steps, they go from black to green, from death to hectic life, from dry-baked limbo to a field of massive thistles and dense hollyhocks. But there was a house here on the borderland that burned, but didn't fall. And against its rear wall there are heat shadows, where something living collapsed against the hot brick and burned with different colours, different breakdown products. 2 of them, one large and one small, painted in deep black against the grey-black of their surroundings. An adult and a child, arms thrown up as though they were caught in the middle of an aerobics workout. Fascinated, the hungry kid measures herself against the smaller shape. It fits her pretty well. Chapter 45. What she thinks is, "This could have been me." Why not? A real girl in a real house, with a mother and a father, and a brother and a sister and an aunt and an uncle and a nephew and a niece and a cousin, and all those other words for the map of people who love each other and stay together. The map called family. Growing up and growing old. Playing. Exploring. Like Pooh and Piglet. And then like the famous five. And then like Heidi and Anne of Green Gables.
And then like Pandora, opening the great big box of the world and not being afraid. Not even caring whether what's inside is good or bad. Because it's both. Everything is always both. But you have to open it to find that out. Chapter 46. They stop and eat, setting their faces against the dead zone they've just crossed. Sergeant Parks has brought some of the tins from the kitchen in Wainwright House with him in his pack. Miss Justineau and Dr. Caldwell and the soldiers eat cold sausage and beans and cold Scotch broth. Melanie eats something called Spam, which is a bit like the meat she had the night before, but not so nice. They face south, away from the thing that Miss Justineau called a burn shadow, but Melanie keeps turning her head to look back the way they've come. They're on a rise in the ground, so she can see a long way to the north, all the way back to the town where they slept last night, and where she loosed the fox. Mile after mile of gentle rise and fall, baked and blackened to charcoal. She catechises Miss Justineau again to make sure she understands, the two of them talking in low voices that don't carry. "Was it green before?" Melanie asks, pointing. "Yes, just like the countryside we passed through right after we left the base."
"Why did they burn it?"
"They were trying to keep the Hungries contained in the first few weeks after the infection appeared."
"But it didn't work."
"No. They were scared and they panicked. A lot of the people who should have been making the important decisions were infected themselves, or else they ran away and hid. The ones who were left didn't really know what they were doing. But I'm not sure there was anything better they could have done. It was too late by then. All the evil shit they were afraid of had already happened, pretty much."
"The evil shit?"
Melanie queries. "The Hungries." Melanie contemplates this equation. It may be true, but she doesn't like it. She doesn't like it at all.
"I'm not evil, Miss Justineau."
Miss J is penitent. She touches Melanie on the arm, gives her a brief but reassuring squeeze. It's not as nice as a hug, but also not so dangerous.
"I know you're not, sweetheart. I wasn't saying that. But I am a Hungry."
A pause. "You're infected," Miss J says. "But you're not a Hungry, because you can still think, and they can't." That distinction hasn't struck Melanie until now, or at least hasn't weighed much against the planetary mass of her realization. But it is a real difference. Does it make other differences possible? Does it make her not be a monster after all? These ontological questions come first, and loom largest. Another, more practical one peeps out from behind them.
"Is that why I'm a crucially important specimen?"
Miss J makes a hurting face, then an angry one. "That's why you're important to Dr. Caldwell's research project. She believes she can find something inside you that will help her to make medicine for everyone else. An antidote. So they can't ever be turned into Hungries, or, if they're turned, they can be changed back again." Melanie nods. She knows that's really important. She also knows that not all the evils that struck this land had the same cause and origin. The infection was bad. So were the things that the important decision people did to control the infection. And so is catching little children and cutting them into pieces, even if you're doing it to try to make medicine that stops people being Hungries. It's not just Pandora who had that inescapable flaw. It seems like everyone has been built in a way that sometimes makes them do wrong and stupid things. Or almost everyone. Not Miss Justineau, of course. Sergeant Parks is signalling to them to stand and start walking again. Melanie walks ahead of Miss Justineau, letting the leash run taut as she revolves all these dizzying things in her mind. For the first time, she doesn't wish that she was back in her cell. She's starting to see that the cell was a tiny piece of something much bigger,
of which everyone who's with her here used to be a part. She's starting to make connections that build outwards from her own existence in some surprising and scary directions. Chapter 47. London swallows them very slowly, a piece at a time. It's not like Stevenage, where you basically walk in from open fields and open roads and find yourself suddenly in the heart of the town. For Kieran Gallagher, who found Stevenage pretty big and impressive, this is an experience at once so intense and so drawn out that it's hard to process. They walk, and they walk, and they walk, and they're still coming into the city, whose heart, Sergeant Parks tells him, is at least another 10 miles south of them at this point. All the places we've passed through today, Helen Justinu tells Gallagher, taking pity on his awe and unease, they used to be separate towns, but the developers just kept building outwards from London as more and more people came to live there, and eventually all those other towns just got absorbed into the mass. How many people? Gallagher knows he sounds like a 10-year-old, but he still has to ask. Millions. A lot more people than there are in the whole of England now. Unless. She doesn't finish the sentence, but Gallagher knows what she means. Unless you count the Hungries. But you can't. They're not people anymore. Well, except for this weird little kid who's like... He's not sure what she's like. A live girl, maybe, dressed up as a Hungry. But not even that. An adult, dressed as a kid, dressed as a Hungry. Weirdly, probing his feelings the way you stick your tongue into the place where a tooth fell out, Gallagher finds himself liking her. And one of the reasons why he likes her is because she's so different from him. She's as big as 4/5 of 5/8 of fuck all, but she takes no bullshit from anyone. She even talks back to the Sarge, which is like watching a mouse bark at a pit bull. Frigging amazing. But he and the kid have got this much in common. They both walk into London with their mouths hanging open, barely able to process what they're seeing. How could there ever have been enough people to live in all these houses? How could they ever have built their towers so high? And how could anything in the whole world ever have conquered them? As the fields beside the road give way to streets, and then more streets, and then a hell of a lot more streets on top of that, they sight more and more Hungries. The Sarge has already told him about the density law. The more living people there once were in any place, the more Hungries will probably be there now, unless it's a place where burn patrols have been through or bombs have been dropped. And that's just what they find. But the thing about the Hungries is that they cluster, just like they did in Stevenage, and with that near disaster fresh in his memory, the Sarge isn't taking any chances. They go slowly, doing recce along parallel streets and choosing the ones where the Hungries aren't. If you're prepared to fake and double a little bit, you can stay clear of the mouldy bastards for long stretches. He and Parks take point on this at first, but increasingly they use the kid because A, she runs no risk, and B, they know after Stevenage that she'll come back. She's the perfect advance scout. The first few times, Sergeant Parks undoes the leash each time and then ties her up again when she comes back. Then one time he forgets to tie her up, or decides not to, and after that the leash just stays tucked in his belt. She's still got the muzzle on, and her hands cuffed behind her, but she walks along with the rest of them, free to stride ahead or dawdle along behind. Then when she comes back, then one time he forgets to tie her up, or decides not to, and after that the leash just stays tucked in his belt. She's still got the muzzle on, and her hands cuffed behind her, but she walks along with the rest of them, free to stride ahead or dawdle along behind. The density of Hungries holds high but steady through most of that afternoon. And then, weirdly, it starts to come down again. It's after they've passed through a place called Barnet, and they're walking along a long, straight road strewn with abandoned vehicles. It's the sort of terrain